Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Listen Up with Jim Potts, only on LA Talk Radio.
Jim Potts back on the air. Good evening, everybody. And as always, I thank you very much for tuning in. Hey, this is our first show of the new year, so let me take a moment just to say Happy New Year to everybody out there. And I hope this year is a happy one for you and a very prosperous and also a healthy year for you. Okay, today we're going to be talking about some statistics about police shootings regarding African Americans. I got an email that I'll read to you, so I want to address that one. And we'll also be discussing and analyzing the characterization of Run, Hide, and Fight. I got another email from a teacher that asked me some questions about that, so I'll be focused on that. And then as a part of my regular routine, I want to give a little historical piece each week. Because my feeling has always been, and I've said it many times on the air, that we have a tendency to forget things. So each week for about 5 minutes, I'm going to reach back into some historical piece just to inform the listeners so that they understand that a lot of this is not new. So we have to understand that and the fact that it's going to keep coming around. So it's what we have to do to prepare for these things. The other one, and the final one that we're going to talk about today, is the unintended evolutionary consequences of border barriers on natural populations. You know, it keeps coming up about this wall and barriers, and I want to be able to address that from a different perspective, some things that I thought about. Well, before we get too far into this, I want to send a message out to Utah. Unfortunately, we're starting the year off already with the death of a Utah cop. All of the information is not even in yet, but these things, as I've said before, are very disheartening. These are individuals that are out there doing the job on behalf of all of us. Okay, let's get busy. I got another email early today regarding the incident that took place in Torrance, California at a bowling alley. See, this is what I'm talking about when I say that we always have to be prepared because you never know what direction is going to come in. And a person has sent me an inquiry because of the fact that they're talking about an active shooter, so I thought that this is an opportunity. You have to understand something. The difference between an active shooter and a mass shooting. The situation with the bowling alley, 3 dead and 4 injured, that's not considered an active shooter situation. Yes, shots were fired. But an active shooter is when a person goes in and they've got this particular intent. You've seen it many times on the news. A mass shooting is just a shooting that takes place when there's at least 3 people or more that are either killed and injured. So the situation at the bowling alley apparently started because of a brawl that broke out. So that's just simply not the same. Yes, it's a shame people died and other people were injured. Hopefully those injured are going to recover. But there's a difference between an incident like that as a mass shooting versus an active shooter situation. So I did want to let you know. Now, of course, you need to prepare, you know, in the same way, because I'm sure some of these people that may have been injured or killed may not even have been a part of whatever the issue was that went on that created this brawl. It was a bowling alley, as I understand it, and I guess two teams may have gotten in it or something of that nature. So, at any rate, all the details aren't out there yet, but I at least wanted to clarify the difference between an active shooter situation and a mass shooting, because there is a difference. Okay. Having gotten past that, let's go to the first email. Jim, as an African American, it is particularly disturbing about the amount of black people that are shot by police officers. In my opinion, these shootings are a part of domestic terrorism. Do you agree or disagree? I'm not talking politics. I'm talking terrorism. So responding to my question shouldn't go against your staying away from politics. I would appreciate an on-the-air response. Joe from Philadelphia. Well, look, Joe, here's the deal. All right? Right, I agree with you. It doesn't necessarily have to be a political issue from that standpoint, but you're asking me a question, and the question really addresses whether or not that's domestic terrorism or not. So I really do want to take a moment. It's the beginning of the year, so maybe it's a good time to do it anyway. And I've actually discussed what domestic terrorism is now. So let me give you the definition of domestic terrorism just so that you understand it. Acts of domestic terrorism are those which involve acts dangerous to human life that are a violation of the criminal laws of the United States or of any state. B, appear to be attended and to intimidate or coerce a civilian population. Subsection that has to influence the policy of a government by intimidation or coercion, or subsection to affect the conduct of a government or mass destruction, assassination, or kidnapping. And lastly, it occurs primarily within the territorial jurisdiction of the United States. Now, Joe, you could probably read into that and formulate your own opinion as to whether or not you think it's domestic terrorism. Well, from my perspective, to answer your question more directly, is that no, I don't believe that's a form of domestic terrorism. I don't. I still think it's a serious issue, and you're asking me about that issue. So I've addressed this on the air before, but it's what I'm going to do, because I don't want to just ignore listeners when they take the time to send things in. I want to talk about the number of people shot to death by police in the United States. And I'm actually going to go back to 2015 through up and to 2018. So I want to make this also clear. I'm going to make a final comment on this, on the issue of police officers killing blacks, because I really don't want to discourage the emails, like I said, or discussions from listeners on this issue. But the realities are police officers do shoot people. We know that. This is unavoidable. So let's look at some stats. And I'm going to take it all the way back to 2015, just so that we have a better understanding out there. And I guess I would implore the listeners not to, every time that there's a shooting of a civilian, a black civilian, you know, the news pumps it up. You get the groups going crazy over the fact that somebody got shot. And a lot of times people jump to these conclusions without even knowing all the facts. And that's the sad part. I wish people would wait till all the facts came out, not just the point that a police officer, you know, shot a black person or a person of color. So let's take a look at this. 2015. So what I did, I looked at, you know, shootings of individuals that were white, black, and Hispanic, and also a category called other. And I did that from 2015 to 2018, although all the numbers are in from 2018. But I will tell you this. In 2015, of the individuals shot by police officers, 50% were white, blacks were 26%, Hispanics were at 17%, and a category called other, where they didn't know the nationality of a person, was at 7%. In 2016, the numbers for whites were 48%, blacks were 24%, Hispanics remained the same at 17%, and the other category rose to 11%. In 2017, whites were at 47%, blacks at 23%, Hispanics at 19%, and the other category went to 12%. 2018, whites went to 41%, or I should say down to 41%, blacks went down to 20%, Hispanics went down to 13%, and the other category, surprisingly, went up to 25%. Now, you have to wonder about some of those stats from that perspective, because over the last few years, we know there's been a lot of controversy over it, so maybe people are being more careful out there. I don't know what the case may be. But in every one of the categories, Joe, just to answer your question, the number of percentages on blacks went down from 26% in 2015 down to 20%. Whites also went down. Now, there are issues regarding unarmed civilians getting killed. So when you look at these stats, we have to wonder unarmed versus armed. But blacks, to be honest with you, blacks appear to have a higher rate of getting killed when they were unarmed. So we have those also, but could have had a knife, you know, or a pipe, or used a vehicle or whatever. So that's an interesting result as well. Now, a final point. Look, I'm curious. Where are the stats of black officers that have shot white civilians, or black officers that have shot other black officers? See, the focus always appears to be just on when blacks get killed. And I don't think that those are fair statistics or fair accounting by the news. I think we have to look at this, you know, on a more even keel, so to speak. I think those stats are just as important. Because when a black officer, and believe me, there's black officers that have shot black civilians as well, and yet you don't hear about those. So I think that there's some unfairness that's going on with the way that the information is being presented. You know, our concern should be any police officer shooting any armed or unarmed civilian, irrespective of their race. So that's my opinion on it, Joe. I don't really want to spend time, you know, always on the air talking about this. I get these emails from individuals, and I just think that we all need to be a little bit patient with this. Here's some numbers that are at least showing some of the numbers are going down, so that's a good thing. And let's just all hope that law enforcement, that they're just doing their job, and hopefully not, you know, being racist in the performance of those duties that so many people allege. Okay, that's all that I want to discuss on that one. Joe, I hope I answered your question. Let's keep moving. My second email. Jim, I am a school teacher. I have listened to your show and heard you discuss the pros and cons of teachers arming themselves. And I and some of my colleagues agree with you. Everyone always talks about run, hide, fight. Can you please venture out with your opinion of this concept? We value your opinion and insight. Thanks, Linda, Phoenix, Arizona. Well, look, first of all, the run, hide, fight concept, just to let you know that, is basically has been given out by the Department of Homeland Security. It's been out for a number of years now. A lot of law enforcement use those three words, run, hide, fight. Now, I'm going to tell you, run, hide, fight has definite benefits that should remain in the creation of a new model. That's what it should be. It's easily remembered, it's adaptable, and it's in sync with natural instincts. Let's face it. Run, hide, fight. That's what it is. Unfortunately, it is so nonspecific that someone not typically trained in high-stress tactical scenarios, such as teachers, all right, and school staff, might have difficulty implementing a model when faced with multiple and changing variables. So, for example, a panicked teacher unfamiliar with movement under fire may inadvertently stray or lead students into a firing lane. No one size fits all, people. All right? No one size fits all approach addresses the evolutionary evolving environment of an active shooter event. Additionally, no mechanism is available during an event to assess the mental state of a shooter rapidly to decide the best course of action. How are you going to know that? A mitigating strategy bolstered by tactical decision-making tools can provide an element of structure to an unpredictable situation. And basically, what am I telling you there? I'm telling you that each situation by itself and the stress of the situation can vary. It can vary by the scenario that's being presented. The run, hide, fight, yes, keep it in your mind. I'm not straying from that. But we also have to understand the importance of preparation for this, which I've spoken about, you know, on a number of occasions as well. Because the realities are, an active shooter events are not a new threat to your institution, Linda, meaning the educational facilities. They remain a consistent threat and have the potential for significant impact. I hate to put it that way, but it's true. Now, in my opinion, response strategies need to evolve beyond the basics of lockdowns, because the school always the way the schools are all set up, they all talk about lockdown. Run, hide, fight provides a firm foundation for the expansion of an options-based response strategy for school-related based active shooter events. So we have that. Now, that's better, as you have already agreed with me in your email, versus arming teachers. Now, I had an inquiry one time. The term lockdown, by the way, refers to a conventional practice in which teachers isolate students in their respective classrooms. They lock the doors and attempt to impede any visibility into the rooms. And, of course, businesses can do it the same way. I'm just specifically addressing schools since Linda's a school teacher and asked me about the information. Lockdowns were designed to address threats from the exterior of the school grounds. So don't forget that. Lockdown means lock all the doors because somebody's trying to get in. All right? In active shooter events, mitigation efforts focused on outside threats become extremely problematic, as the shooter may have already assessed the interior of the school. So lockdown procedures are one thing if you get a heads up that somebody's coming in. But if you look at all of these school shootings, Parkland, Columbine, a lot of these school shootings, there's no heads up to this the majority of the times. Although I shouldn't say that, because we have found where law enforcement's been cracking down and they have had opportunities to be able to address these issues before the person even got there. But a lot of the times the lockdown, you know, is difficult to do because these individuals already get inside. So if you're going to have a lockdown procedure per se, it's got to be when all the students are inside and they're in class, and now you've got some kind of lockdown procedure where nobody can get in. But again, sometimes these individuals get very creative because some of them have attended the school as well. All right. Now, a strategic limitation is that once committed to an area perceived as secure, teachers and staff may have limited opportunities to reevaluate the responses and change their actions. What am I telling you by that? Well, and this is for businesses as well sometimes. What I'm telling you is that if you're in a lockdown in the classroom and things, the conditions have changed, and you're focused only in one area, that could be problematic. And by the way, if anybody has any questions or anybody wants to call in, as usual, I always give out the number. It's 818-602-4929. That's 818-602-4929. And, you know, if you go to the website, you can always get that number there also if that's easier for you. Or you can send me an email at listenupwithjp@pottsandassociates.com. And if you want to get my blogs and email blast about upcoming show topics, so that you'll know in advance about what I'm going to be talking about, text POTS Associates, that's capital POTTS, capital ASSOCIATES, that's all one word, POTS Associates is all one word, and text that to 22828 and enter your email address, and you'll get the notifications beforehand about what it's going to be, what's going to be on the show. Again, that's POTS Associates. And text it to 22828 and enter your email address, and you'll get the email blast before the weekly show so that you'd be able to tune in. Now, let's take a look at something. Research has found that commitment to a winning mindset could be a critical component in the potential survival of a threatening event. And I'm talking whether it's a business or a school or you're just out and about. All right, mindset. That's what we have to think about. Awareness, being vigilant, being safe, mindset. Now, a lot of research addresses handling stressful situations and the impact of stress on decision making. And this is in the trainings that I do where I tell people panic reaction versus reflex reaction. If you go over these things over and over again in your mind, that what if scenarios, and you practice these things, sit down with your families and you talk about these things. What would happen if? That's what we're talking about. It's less impactful stress, you know, from a stress standpoint, if you get in that scenario. Now, Linda, teachers and school staff, while not frequently faced with situations of this type, might engage actively in practicing the principles of functioning in stressful environments. It does not cost money to practice and perfect situational awareness, mindset preparation, and a willingness to succeed. Because as you know, if you're in the school system, you know that money is always an issue. So how much is it going to cost? How much is it going to cost? Not that we're putting a value on human life. I get that. But the realities are is that this, what I'm telling you right now, does not cost a dime for somebody to sit down, you know, within the organization or within the school administration to sit down and go through this. And quite frankly, a lot of this you can probably get online now, Linda, as well. And so it doesn't cost anything. The only thing that the schools need to do is to sit down with their staffs and go over, the drills, go over what's practical, the procedures that they would follow. That, to me, is what's important. You know, again, staying away from the gun situation. Now, it's critical the school systems emphasize the importance of preparedness. That's my feeling. And a desire to support the readiness process. You know, I remember when I was younger, and they probably still do it, you know, we used to have the fire drills. We used to like fire drills, quite frankly. You know, I mean, because we got out of class for a few minutes. So fire drills were pretty cool. But you should still be considering the same thing. Fire drills or the active shooter drills, all of these things make for practice so that if something happens, everybody's already going to know what to do. Part of the problem, in my opinion, people never think it can happen to them. And then you hear about something on the news, the people are being interviewed, and they all say the same thing. Never thought it would happen at our school. It's not just a school, it's a business, the businesses also. Now, I'll tell you, with the appropriate mindset, practices in place, teachers, Linda, and school staff can work to familiarize themselves with task-level tactical practices. It doesn't cost a dime. You just have to sit down and do it. And like I said, every scenario is going to be a little bit different. So have some fundamentals in place so that in the event that something happens from generally, you're going to know what to do. Now, I will tell you, while much of the tactical advice and techniques described may seem intimidating to non-military and non-law enforcement professionals, I'm telling you they're not. Once you start doing this, it is simple. It's a simple process. The main thing to do is to understand that in the event that something happens, that you're not going to be in a total panic mode. Now, I'm not going to say that people are not going to be scared and all of that. That's not what I'm saying. But you want to have it to be more of a reflex situation than a panic situation. And teachers, Linda, as you know, are there to protect the children. So the more that this gets, you know, practiced as an example, is the easier it's going to make it for you and easier for the students. And if they don't see the teacher panicking and the teacher is being level-headed, going through the drills as he or she has been taught to do, then that's going to go a long way when something happens. Now, tactics, Linda, can be broken down to their simplest components. You can provide basic guidance and movement and self-protection strategies that have a potential of furthering the likelihood of survival, because honestly, isn't that what it's all about? Survival. Blocking those doors, all right, turning out the lights, having the kids be quiet, getting them into closets or whatever it is that may be in the classroom. I think on one of the other shows I talked about how some of the schools have these little kits now that have, they have like a hammer in there so that they can break out windows if need be, things that they can throw if need be, first aid kit if need be. So some of the schools are going in that direction. One gentleman from one of these universities, I think it was up in the Bay Area, that's putting hockey pucks in all of the classrooms because of how hard a hockey puck is. And if somebody does break through the barrier, they're all going to start throwing hockey pucks at them. Hey, a hockey puck is hard, all right? Anyway, look, here's what you have to understand. You've got to be committed. And this is for everybody out there that's listening, because everybody could be confronted with this type of scenarios or any of these scenarios that we talk about on the air. And I'll tell you this. What is the commitment? You've got to have the will to survive. You got to have a warrior mindset, because the goal is for teachers or people out in the general public, professionals, to feel empowered in their ability to adapt to a multitude of threatening environments. You know, isn't it ironic that we as Americans are talking about this over the last few years? Even though this is, like I told you before, this has been around for a long time. But think about people in other countries that walk through life from the moment they're born until, you know, the moment they die, you know, later in life, that has to do the things we're talking about right now. For them, it became a more routine situation because of the way that they were living. You know, we're here in the United States. We have our opportunities here. And, you know, some of that's being, you know, interfered with, so to speak, now because of everything that's going on. We like going to the movies. We like doing this. We like doing that. And we have our own comfort zones. And now we're in situations where we're being taken out of our comfort zones. Well, you know what? Time moves on. And because time moves on, situations move on, we just have to adapt to it. And hopefully at some point, you know, this is all going to calm itself down to the degree that things are happening right now. Because, again, you've heard me say it, domestic terrorism has been around since the late 1700s in one form or another. Granted, it hasn't been like it is now, but it's still been around for a long time. So it's not like it's going to ever probably completely go away. because we can't control people's mindset or things that go wrong with them mentally. Can't control that. You know, with the internet putting out information all the time. What was it? Somebody was arrested not too long ago. The FBI arrested a guy who put how to make a bomb on the internet. So, I mean, it's just those, that's part of the problem also. Technology is, excuse the expression, somewhat backfiring on us because this information is so easy to get. It's easy to put things out there that make people unhappy, and now the word spreads, so it's spreading a lot quicker. You know, back in the days, you know, when they were talking about the American Revolution and, you know, the 1700s and the 1800s, the newspaper, you guys have seen and heard those stories. A guy may have gotten a newspaper a month later, 2 months later. Now we're getting it instantaneously. Makes a big difference. Now, finding some research, I want to tell you, fall really into three categories that you need to think about. The three categories that I focus on with this is what we call pre-action, action, and reaction. Now look, pre-action refers to the steps leading up to an event that establish the necessary mindset and confidence for survival. And it creates an awareness that carries over into the action phase. So pre-action, getting ready, being prepared. Action refers to the actual response to a threat, the tactical movements that you would do, and techniques that potential victims implement to increase their opportunity to survive. And then action carries into reaction and vice versa. They kind of feed off of each other. It's like a loop. And reaction means the reevaluation phase of the situation. It analyzes whether the actions taken are improving or worsening the tactical advantage that may have been set up by the school or the business, etc. Now, that analysis that you would go through after that determines the next course of action. Mistakes that we made, we're not going to make them the next time. We weren't prepared. How were we not prepared? That's what you sit down and figure out. Again, it's a loop system. It takes seconds to process this if you're prepared. What did I tell you? Panic reaction versus reflex reaction. You get the reflex reaction because what? You have been prepared. So when something actually happens, you have seconds. Okay, where these things will go through your head, not taking minutes because you're trying to figure out what to do, because minutes can be deadly. Because the reality is, when you have an active shooter, a lot of the active shooter situations take place, they could be over in 5 minutes, 6 minutes. Those are the numbers. So you don't have 5 or 6 minutes to think about this. You've only got seconds to think about this. Now, remember those three things. You're talking pre-action, you're talking about action, and then you're talking about reaction when you turn around and you go over this a little bit later. So look, I'm going to make three recommendations. Here's your first one, Linda. Provide training. Make sure that they provide training to you and the school staff on options-based response to an active shooter, preparedness and response, including defensive tactics and tactical decision-making. My second recommendation, they need to empower the teachers through the district, because the district is the one that controls a lot of these schools, to protect the children in their care by any means necessary. All right, so whatever you have to do, and we've heard it on the news where some teachers have given up their lives because they got in the gunman's way to stop them from shooting some of the kids. And the third recommendation, establish reconnection procedures in the event of an incident. All right. Now look, we can talk about these things, but you got to implement these things. Listening to it on the radio is one thing, but actually doing it is another. And that's an emphasis that I always go through. You have to be prepared. The only way to prepare is for practice, practice, practice. And that's what you have to do. So, Linda, I hope that was helpful for you. For others listening, you know, the run, hide, fight, that's, you know, once again, that's good. But you've got to understand about being prepared beforehand. Because if you recognize these options-based approaches as an acceptable strategy, school systems will have the potential of dramatically increasing the likelihood of survival. Lockdown should be an option, but let me make it clear, it should not be the solution. It's not enough. This nation, as a society, entrusts teachers with the daily protection of our children. So we have to empower them with the tools and opportunity to evolve that protection in an ever-increasing threatening environment. Sad but true, those are the times that we're living in. And it's very disheartening for us to watch the news and see about another incident at a school. We have to take the affirmative steps, Linda, to make sure that these schools are doing what they're supposed to be doing. All right? And the concept for all the other listeners, run, hide, fight, like I said, it's a good concept. But go over the scenarios. What would I do if? Okay, I'm going to move on now. As I told you earlier, I want to talk about a piece of the show to always include like an historical recap, so to speak, of events that took place in our history that we have a tendency to forget about. And I've chosen this one because of everything that's going on right now in Washington, D.C. So I want to talk about the D.C. sniper attacks. The D.C. sniper attacks. I bet if I had to ask you about it, you couldn't even remember when that was. Well, I'm going to help you out a little bit here. It was in October of 2002. They also called it, by the way, the Beltway sniper attacks. And that was a series of coordinated shootings that occurred over a three-week period. 3 weeks. The states that were impacted by it, for you to recall, Maryland, Virginia, and the District of Columbia. Now, 10 people were killed and 3 others were critically wounded in the Baltimore-Washington metropolitan area and along Interstate 95 in Virginia. So for those of you that are familiar with back east, 95 is a major freeway like we have out here with the 5 or the 405, etc. Now, just to refresh your memories, the snipers were John Allen Muhammad. He was 41 at the time. And Lee Boyd Malvo, he was 17. And they traveled around in this blue 1990 Chevy Capri sedan. And their crime spree actually had begun in February 2002. All right? They actually began in February. So from February to October, these two individuals were on the loose. It included murders and robberies in the state of Alabama, Arizona, Florida, Georgia, Louisiana, Texas, and the state of Washington. And all of that resulted in 7 deaths and 7 wounded people in that 10 months. So within that time frame, they killed 17 people and wounded 10 others. So 27 people and families were impacted by the actions of these two individuals. Now, in September of 2003, Muhammad, he paid the ultimate price for his behavior. Because as you know, they caught him. So the 41-year-old, just to refresh your memory, they were caught, they were convicted, and Muhammad was sentenced to death. And he paid the ultimate price. Malvo, he was sentenced to 6 consecutive life sentences. That's the youngster at 17. 6 consecutive life sentences without the possibility of parole. But I have to tell you, in 2009, I should tell you that Muhammad was sentenced to death in 2003, but he wasn't executed until 2009 by lethal injection. But in 2017, the youngster, Malvo, his conviction to a life sentence without parole was overturned on appeal in Virginia, with resentencing ordered pursuant to the Supreme Court's ruling, which voided mandatory life sentence punishments for adolescent criminals as legally unconstitutional. So under the resentencing structure, his minimum prison sentence will be determined by a judge eventually, and available maximum sentence would be life imprisonment. All right. So the ruling's it's not going to apply to the 6 life sentences that he's received in Maryland, because remember, this is all over all these different states. Now, I'll tell you something about Virginia, which is where Muhammad was executed. Virginia actually is the first state to execute anybody. Their first capital punishment execution was in the 1600s. So let me tell you something. If you're going to mess around and you're going to do some killing, don't do it in Virginia. They don't play around out there. All right. Okay. So that's the historical piece that I wanted to cover. And now is what I will do is talk to you about a very sensitive area. This issue about the border. Look, as you know, I told you when I was on the intelligence team, my area of specialization was Central and South America. And I've said it on so many occasions that, look, if we ever have a major issue in this country, it's going to come up through our southern border. Think about something. It's not going to come by air. It's not going to come by sea. And it's not going to come down through Canada. Now, again, I will emphasize, because I don't want to get the hate mail, I have no issue with people trying to come to our country for a better living. I can understand it. If I was in that situation, I'd probably want my family here as well. All right? But with all of the controversy, I actually did some research and found, because this issue has come up on the show before, about the actual unintended evolutionary consequences of border barriers on natural populations. You're like, wow, yeah, what's that all about? Well, let me just tell you. We know that there's a major political issue about building this wall at our southern border. And again, I want to make it clear, I'm not going to take sides because I understand both points of view. But there's a major, major issue regarding building a wall, all right, and that has not been discussed. And that's the piece that I want to discuss because I think that this needs to be taken into consideration about this wall, all right? So, and here's what it is. There are these biological implications of human-made barriers dividing natural populations. This is a critical issue, as I found out, and there's an urgent challenge for scientists and policymakers to understand the impact of building these walls. Now, by the way, construction of border barriers is not a new phenomenon. You should know that, even from your basic history class, for those of you who didn't fall asleep in history. I was a history major. When you think about a wall, what wall do you think about? Well, there's the Great Wall of China, and there was the Berlin Wall. And now there's contemporary walls between the United States and Mexico. Humanity's history of erecting border barriers spans thousands of years. So understand that. And current border barriers exist between Israel and the West Bank, Malaysia and Thailand, India and Pakistan, Iran and Iraq, and China and Mongolia, and Botswana and Zimbabwe. And there's others out there. But here's the real issue. People put these barriers up, but we really don't know the impact on the ecological and evolutionary outcomes in natural populations. Now think about that for a moment. Let's go back hundreds of years, thousands of years. There was less people. People moved freely from one place to another. That's how these cultures developed. How they assimilated each other, how we evolved as human beings. Now, there's no clear review directly summarizing the potential evolutionary impacts on these border barriers at a time where biodiversity is rapidly declining on a global scale, I found out. Yeah, biodiversity. Who ever heard of that? Well, you have to be a scientist, I guess. And I'm not a scientist, so let me just make that clear. We don't know because there's a lack of information, which is particularly due to the fundamental characteristics of border barriers. First, border barriers are built between two countries, which have different laws and practices associated with conducting scientific research on the biological impacts of these structures. Second, border barriers are commonly built for security reasons, and there's often restricted access to these areas on either side as a result. Look at the Berlin Wall. Let's use that one as an example. Reagan went down there and said, Mr. Gorbachev, take that wall down. Remember that? Third, best practices and strategies for mitigating the negative effects of human-made barriers on wildlife. Wildlife, we don't even think about that, could compromise the intended security purposes of border barriers. Fourth, the environmental laws intended to protect biodiversity along border areas can be temporarily waived in the interest of national security and safety. All right? And next and last, borders are often created along natural geographic boundaries. Therefore, border barriers can amplify the historical effects of natural barriers on biodiversity. Biodiversity, from what I've read, is very, very important. That's how we exist as humans on this earth. We move around. We do things. We spread culture. You know, ideas, concepts. Walls prevent that. Walls prevent that. Now, here's what, in my opinion, what needs to be considered from what I've, you know, from what I've researched. There are three predicted evolutionary outcomes in response to border walls, I found out. Divergence due to natural selection and or genetic drift as gene flow decreases. Gene flow. What are they saying? All right. Two, immediate and long-term changes to effective population size, including population bottlenecks and changes to genetic variations. The other issue that we have to worry about, inbreeding. If you have people in a confined area, a lot of inbreeding can result as a result of that. So that's interesting. Well, look, think about something. Border barriers are a human-made form of geographic isolation, which, by the way, is defined as population of species that live in an area that are typically near each other but do not overlap in space because of some barrier that keeps them separated. And typically, geographic isolation arrives when geographic barriers prevent gene flow between previously interbreeding populations of the same species. Doesn't that make sense? So if you look at it just from that standpoint alone, this tells us that these barriers are not good. But I will say, because again, I understand both sides, I also understand the need for security. So this is why this is presenting such a problem for us. We do need the security. Now, so just I'm just presenting this from a scientific standpoint, obviously. And the issues that I'm presenting, I've not heard anybody out there arguing about. Now, one might predict that as gene flow decreases, populations can diverge and evolve along different paths. So you have to think about that. You know, when I first started looking at all of this, I could not see, you know, this issue as being an issue. And now, from what I understand, they're not really doing a quote-unquote wall. It looks like they're actually doing, because I was reading earlier today, where they might actually, instead of be creating the so-called wall, that they're doing a barrier of sorts where they have the slats so they can actually see through it, so it's not technically a wall. So, but it's still, in my opinion, a barrier of sorts that's designed, obviously, to keep people out. So that in itself stops the natural flow. But here we are. We have the people on one side that want to argue everybody should be able to come here. And then, of course, we have people on the other side that say, well, there's not an issue with them coming here, but they want them to come here in a certain way. They want them to come here legally. That's not hard to understand either. Now, I do recall that they had a gentleman on the news about a year and a half ago that was talking about these so-called walls. And this is before all of the data was out there, quite frankly, that was talking about butterflies, about how the wall would be too tall for butterflies to fly over and that could create some kind of imbalance, so to speak, or something of that nature. And when I first heard that, I kind of chuckled about that. Butterflies, I mean, why can't they just fly over? But apparently they only fly to a certain height, end of story. So there is some growing concern out there, and obviously, like I said, I did the research on this and found it. So this is an area, though, that needs to be taken into consideration before any final decision, so to speak, is made, or before some structure is built. Hopefully they are going to take some of this into consideration. Now, look, the politicians don't always talk to us about what their intent is and what they're going to do. And they just go out there and do it. They've got the information behind the scenes, and they don't necessarily always, you know, show us or tell us exactly, you know, what's going on. Now, I think border security is important. I think that based upon the training that I had previously, I think there are some major concerns regarding the potential for us to have a major issue, and that issue will come from the South. And I don't mean from the people that are coming here trying to make a living. I'm talking about the people that might be contained within those groups of trying to get here that might try to create a major problem for us. There's some places down in South America and Central America. There's a place called the Friendship Bridge. They don't even require to move from one continent to another, basically. It's not being patrolled. They could just walk across. No identification, no nothing. They could just come across. And then is what they do. They filter up through, you know, the South America. They come straight on up. So what I've been reading in the news, even with this caravan situation, where they've actually caught some people that have, been classified as terrorists, if you will. And as a result of that, they've been stopped, to make a long story short. Now, there are some countries that are trying to do some monitoring down there. But again, these guys, the way that they work, they're going to get through. It's just a matter of time. So when we look at this business about the wall, the evolutionary impact, in my opinion, about the wall, I think these are really considerations that we have to think about. Now, I want to tell you just in closing here in the next couple of minutes that some reminders. I've mentioned this from time to time in the past. I have people who have listened that have never taken my active shooter training, but I like to, from time to time, because I pick up new listeners, to talk about how to be safe out there. So just remember something. If you're out and about and you're at the malls, if it's a mall that you frequent all the time, make sure that you know where the barriers are within the malls. Make sure that you know where the restrooms are at the malls, or some other places, or some of these outdoor venues, to make sure that you understand, because that's what happened in Las Vegas. They had barriers. People were saved because they went behind barriers. So remember that word barrier. When you're out and about, always know where the barriers are, the safe places. And if there's an active shooter at the mall, just remember, do not run in the thick of the flow. Stay to the outside of the flow. And remember that all of those shops that you're running past, they all have exits at the rear of the shops. So you could duck into one of those, and they're going to be locking their doors down because they've gotten training as well, and they get all of their merchandise through their rear exit, so that would be an exit for you to be able to get out. The other thing is, once again, don't be walking. When you're walking in Old Town USA, stay to the inside of the sidewalk, not the outside of the sidewalk, so that individuals that are jumping the curves with these vehicles, they don't necessarily run down the whole sidewalk. They do it towards the half, that's towards the street side, because they want to be able to keep going and not get caught. So when you're walking out there with your family, stay to the inside of the sidewalk, not the outside of the sidewalk. Okay, movie theaters. Well, look, movie theaters are very confined. You know, it's interesting. We've only had one incident at a movie theater in Colorado, but people are always kind of on guard at movie theaters. But they have one or two exits in there, depending on what side you're sitting on. Some people like to sit right directly in the middle, because if the shooter comes in from the left, you can go out to the right, etc. So sitting in the middle is always going to be a good place to sit. In office buildings, if you're in an office, if something happens, you turn off your lights, you close your door, get underneath your desk so you make it look like nobody is there. Shooters don't really kick down doors, shoot door locks off and all of that. They don't do that, all right? They know that the response time for law enforcement is minutes now. It's minutes away, so they're moving very quickly. So whatever you can do to hide, barricade, or whatever the case may be, or within your own organizations, know where your secure rooms are. A secure room is a room that has no windows and the door locks. So like a storage room, as an example. You get in there, you can lock the door, nobody can get in. So know where your secure facilities are within your organization, okay? Okay, there's just a few tips. Believe me, over this year, I'm going to be giving out more tips from time to time as well. I want to wish you again a happy new year. Please be careful out there, and more importantly, don't think it can't happen to you. This issue about panic reaction versus reflex reaction, I'm just telling you, it works. So do it. All right, you've been listening to Jim Potts on LA Talk Radio. It's time to close out the show, but let me remind you that you can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/JimPottsAuthor. Be sure to join me next week. And hey, by the way, if you like what you heard, do me a favor, spread the word. Until then, be aware, be vigilant, and be safe.
You're listening to Listen Up with Jim Potts, only on LA Talk Radio.